and welcome to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, where you'll hear advice from experienced safety leaders on how to protect your people and business. I'm Peter Steinfeld. Today, I'm talking with Andrew Dingy, pilot, safety expert, and author of Delivering the Right Stuff, a book about the evolution of safety in the airline industry. Andrew has held senior safety leadership roles in two high-stakes sectors, aviation and oil and gas. Today, he's a master at developing systems that keep people and property safe. Let's listen in. Hey, Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for the invite. I'm glad to be here today.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about your book and everything else you know. So for starters, can you tell us just a bit about your journey and how you became a safety expert and author?
Yeah, you bet. Joined the Marine Corps back in, let's just say it was a few years ago. Out of that, out of the aviation selection, was able to go fly fighters, flew Harriers for the Marine Corps, 27 years, did 13 active, about 14 in the reserves. In 99, a lot of us were heading out of the military and going into the commercial airline industry, so got hired to fly 727s for a major U.S. carrier. And then unfortunately, the swings of the industry, I ended up getting laid off, but they were kind enough to allow me to go work for them in their safety department. And a lot of training, a lot of expertise, got really familiar with the safety programs of a major U.S. carrier. And then, you know, I went back and started flying for them again. And the second downturn after the financial crisis once again put me kind of out on the streets. But in this case, I worked for a major oil and gas company, and they were very curious on why you don't hear about airplane accidents. And they themselves were having incidents. And I didn't have a good answer, quite frankly. So it took a little bit of research. And as I did the research, the book kind of started writing itself. And each chapter was, if you will, a pivotal point of the airline industry where it decided to become a high reliable organization and accept this change, if you will, from the accident and change it to a system learning and get better and better and better. And once I started piecing together, the book, like I said, kind of wrote itself. And then from then on, I've been coaching other industries and other companies on how to become high reliable.
Well, those seem to be very different industries. So do you adopt a similar approach to safety in both aviation and oil and gas?
I do. And you could take it to manufacturing. You take it to the medical world as well. And the foundations, a lot of it's James Reason with the Swiss cheese analogy. It's defense in depth, that every accident, near miss, incident has four pieces of cheese associated with it. What most industries are very good at is looking at the person who made the mistake at the field level. Unfortunately, maybe they go down the blame issue or they actually try to learn how the error occurred and then put systematic changes in place. What I'd offer to you, the industry, the aviation industry was kind of first leading the charge, if you will, in a system investigation. And then they look at the individual and the mistake that they made. They give them grace that they made a mistake because he's human. Then they look at the preconditions. That's the human factors, human performance element that why perhaps maybe it was a 2 a.m. circadian low where you're not 100% making the best decisions. Or then you got to look at the supervisor and you got to look at the organization role that they played in the incident. Money, resource management always or can be part of that matrix of why the incident occurred.
You know, when I first started reading your book, I noticed right off the bat, you said it's essentially vital to plan for human error during execution because we can't just rely on people to have the right stuff to just do the right thing. On paper, it looks great, but in reality, we're human. We mess up. So was there a particular experience or something that led you to essentially drive you to write the book, Delivering the Right Stuff?
Yeah, sure did. The more I started working with different companies across different industries, I realized the expectation of management, of leadership, was that you're going to be perfect. You're going to go out there and you do the best job every single time. And the industry I was coming from was we had tools like checklists and the assumption my boss knew that I'm not perfect. So he would absorb and understand as long as I could learn from my mistakes and then put it into a system so other people wouldn't make the same mistake. You constantly get better and better and better. So continuous improvement is an element of that.
So the word checklist does seem to get thrown around a lot these days. And I think it came out of the airline industry and it went into the medical industry. I know doctors have found tremendous benefit from that. But could you just elaborate on some of the common misconceptions about checklists? Like how do organizations use them properly in their safety programs? I can imagine they could seem overbearing.
They can. It's a great question. And one of my, I love checklists. I was, interesting part of it is that I came into a culture that checklists were expected to be used. And so, you know, I was inherited people's mistakes written on checklists for me to make sure I don't make the same mistake. There was an easy buy-in, if you will, for being a pilot. Now, if you step outside in the industries and go medical, manufacturing, construction, that's not quite right. The person's supposed to be perfect. and they don't have a tool or a crutch sometimes is what a checklist looks like. Now, probably the biggest issue with checklists that I've seen other people or industries use is that they take a procedure, they shrink it down, and it's a to-do checklist. But that's not the checklist I inherited. That's not the checklist I use for flying a commercial airliner. My checklist is written in blood. It's very specific on 7 to 11 items. It's past tense, which means I use my memory to conduct my work, my flows, to set the cockpit up for takeoff. It's all off memory. The checklist then goes back and validates. It's QC, QA type checklist, mm-hmm. and it only takes 20 seconds to use. If you give people a to-do checklist, you're destroying their situational awareness. They're now walking around the well site, they're walking around the construction site, reading a piece of paper, losing SA awareness of what's on around them, which could lead to an incident. And if you ever seen the gorilla video when somebody has the basketball team walking around, I use that. It's a great video explaining loss of situational awareness. You can go to YouTube, you can Google it. There's a couple of them out there. But what you'll see is two teams. You'll see a team of folks in white t-shirts, another team is in black t-shirts. And the task is simple. It is all you have to do is count how many times the people in the white shirts catch the basketball. And so I'm going to channelize your attention with that request. And that's loss of situational awareness. It's the same thing if I ask you to pick up the phone. In that video, as you count and you go to 14, 15, 16, in the middle of the video, there's a guy in a gorilla suit that walks through, stops, beats his chest, and then continues. And you'll see about 80% of the folks, when they've never seen the video before, they don't see the gorilla that comes through. And in fact, I played a second time, given the same task, but coach them a little bit about eye scan and how to continue to look around and try to pick up other threats, if you will, in the video. Then they catch it and usually laugh and get a good chuckle out of it.
That's fantastic. And it seems like what you're saying here is the checklist is not something you give to people. It's something that they just internalize. And then it's just there to maybe trigger their memory a little bit. That's about it.
I'd like actually not to be internalized. I'd like to have it on a piece of paper. I've learned also a lot of people like a digital readout so you know you've completed it. So there's a date time stamp on it. Checklists are also, so in this context is when do you use a checklist? Let me kind of clarify your question a bit. And you're supposed to use a checklist in what's called a pause point. It's the low of execution. So you have workload management. When it's real busy, if you give somebody a checklist, more likely than not, they're not going to use it. You're not going to get the buy-in because it's interrupting busy workflows that they normally don't want to use. And so now you've interjected a tool that prevents it from being used. Interesting enough, checklist titles are really important, Peter. Ours are called before takeoff, before BHA going into the hole, before or after checklist. That tells the reader when to use it. So you can see if it says before, you've set everything up before you go to the next phase of work activity. And you're QCing the work that you just did, or also making sure some of the things are done previously before you engage into it.
And it seems like if you use the right checklists in the right time, you're going to prevent problems downstream. But let's say you do get into a situation where there's an unexpected emergency. Are checklists helpful then?
Yeah, so love the question. There's like three types of checklist. Emergency checklist is another type. And the airline industry back in, it was mid-1990s, came out with what's called a quick reference checklist. When I first joined a major carrier and flew 727s, I had to memorize like 85 items off about 13 to 14 different checklist items, or you know, engine fire, things like that, evacuation. And we were good about 85 to 87%. And the FAA said pilots had to have a minimum score of 80% on these memorized items. So you'd be in the simulator, you'd have a fire light come on, you'd have to do four immediate action items off memory. Well, we're not perfect in that space. And so after doing some human studies on memory and how to recall it in the heat of battle, if you will, they came out with what's called a quick reference checklist. And they realized if you could slow things down and grab the checklist, you knew that engine fire was on that checklist. And then you could have, or maybe have, the immediate procedure items were placed on it. So reaching forward and reading the right checklist would slow things down by 2 seconds, but the reliability went up to 99.99%.
Wow.
Yeah. So they determined the 2 second delay to get it right was well worth it by me sitting down there trying to go through it all on my own.
So like when Captain Sully was landing the plane in the Hudson, was his team looking at one of those quick checklists?
Yeah, he was, and he was really good at giving the FO a lot of credit on reaching forward, and then they had to restart their engines or try to attempt to get them restarted. In doing so, he went to electronic checklist on that airplane to get it restarted.
So can you share an example maybe from your experience of how a checklist can make a really significant positive impact for our organization?
Yeah, I'll share it. It's in my book as well. It's probably a very humbling moment for me on my own mistake. But I was de-icing in Denver, and that throws a wrench in the normal flow of how you get your work done. So very routine work, do it all the time, getting off the gates, getting the engine started, flaps set, et cetera, taxi to the runway. But in this case, since we're de-icing, we don't lower our flaps. And so very non-standard, but it's a busy activity. You taxi away from the gate at Denver to de-ice at these pads right prior to the runway. And so the flaps stay up. And for the folks who aren't familiar with the flaps, that's the trailing and leading edge flaps that you see move cycle out probably as you're leaving the gate area. That creates and generates more lift for the airplane. Airplanes have a very bad record that if those don't come down and you try to go flying, it doesn't end well. And so here's probably one of the most critical things I have to do off memory that I forget because we go to de-ice. And so we start taxiing out after de-ice, nice clean wing. I'm supposed to get him out by then, and I had forgotten. So we're taxiing out. We read the checklist. It's the before takeoff checklist. On it, it asks what the flap settings are. And this is a great check on a killer item, if you will. And they're up. And my heart stops. I mean, I'm now, and I consider myself a Marine fighter pilot, done a lot of things in airplanes, that this is the one thing that I would probably never forget, but I did because of distractions, because of workloads, because of changes in the environment. All those things that added up, human performance-wise, I wasn't as good as I could have been that day. And the captain, and this is the culture I'm in, it's so beautiful because he looks at me and he goes, that's why we have checklists. Mm. He wasn't upset, wasn't disappointed, just wanted to make sure we're reading the checklist and verifying that those conditions are set before we take off.
No, that's an excellent story. It seems like I could use these in my personal life as well. So why are checklists so effective in your operating world?
So Peter, if you don't mind, I'm going to run you through a quick little drill, okay?
All right.
Here's what I'd like you to do. I'm going to very simple task. I want you to go January to December as fast as you can, month by month. Are you ready?
Just run through the calendar.
Yep, month by month, so all 12 of them. Gosh. Are you ready?
Okay.
Go.
January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December.
Perfect. Love it. That's what we call routine work. And there's also something called System One when it comes to making decisions. Okay. You've done it before. You're trained at it. You're very good at it. You've delivered reliable outcome. Now, one more question for you. I'd like you to do it backwards. Starting from December to January as fast as you can. Are you ready?
Oh my gosh. This is going to be painful. Let's see. December, November, October, September, August, July, June, May, April, March, February, January. Did I skip something?
Love it. No, you're perfect. But you demonstrated how we work, how we make decisions. That's called non-routine work. And if you noticed, you looked up, which is you had to turn on System 2 is what that's called. System 1 is automated work. You've done it many times driving a car. System 2 is when your system processor turns on, it's your conscious processor. It's slow. It's methodical. It does not multitask. You've probably heard people's conversations about, oh, you can multitask. Others will say you can't. It depends what mode you're on. If you've done the work a lot, you can drive a car and talk on the phone. I'm not saying that's safe, but I am saying that you can do two things at once. I could have thrown you a tennis ball if we were in person. And when you were going January, December, you would have caught it and kept going. Maybe a small hesitation, but you would have kept going. But going backwards, could you have caught the ball?
Nope. No.
You would have had to make a choice, wouldn't you? You're going to forget the ball and continue, or you're just going to catch the ball and then forget their sequence of months. So that's System 1, System 2 analogy. So you asked me why checklists are so effective. System 2 turns on to read a checklist. You have to write your checklist correctly. If they're check, 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 you'll automate the answers and you're not getting the response out of your operating system you're looking for. So instead, you want a challenge question on a status of something. In my case, from the flaps that I gave earlier, is what is the flap setting? It's not flap set or checked. It is flaps 1, and we verified flaps 1 by looking at the indicator, and there's also a little glass indicator you check to make sure they deploy to flaps 1. And so System 2 is your smart processor. It's your analytical one. It's the one you catch errors on. So that airline operating system is, we need System 1 for the speed. You notice the time was about twice as long to do System 2 doing it backwards. So the airline industry does get measured in time, which is not healthy necessarily, but they depend on System 1 being highly reliable, but the checklist catches or traps a human error because it's a smart processor that's validating the things that could hurt your system or hurt you.
I think that's a phenomenal differentiation. And I think it'll help a lot of our listeners go back to what their folks do and really challenge them and say, hey, I know you're really good at your job and you can do these things, but here's where problems can happen. And we want you to slow down. We don't want you to be on autopilot. We want you to really be engage that analytical side of your brain that makes you slow down and think through that you really did it. I had an example over the weekend where we left a hotel and forgot something and had to turn around after driving an hour to go back and get it. If I had a little checklist, don't forget that one item. We wouldn't have to deal with that.
Gotta love the conversation. So when I go to like manufacturing floors or the construction sites, I go to the senior folks, the supervisors, and go, before you leave, what do you check? And that is my initial draft checklist. And then I blend in some other folks that have probably, because those are all lessons learned, aren't they? But those write themselves, and you have the experienced folks that used to do the work now have oversight, and what they go is check the quality, if you will, of their work. That is a great initial checklist.
Yeah, it's like operationalizing wisdom.
I'm going to steal that. That's a perfect, that's so well said.
Well, in your book, and you've talked about it here as well, you mentioned how the airline industry really migrated away from blaming the individual. You just gave us an example of how the pilot treated you, to really just understanding that people make mistakes and why they make mistakes. So what about incident reporting? How do organizations develop a culture that really fully embraces owning and learning from mistakes? That's not easy for humans.
Very good point. And again, I was blessed to walk into a community that already said, hey, we make mistakes. Don't try to make them. We've always strive to be the best you can, but something's going to get in your way sooner or later. And in that case, we're not going to point you in the chest. We're not going to fire you. We're not going to use fear, because fear will crush an incident reporting program. If you think you're going to lose your job by admitting you made a mistake, your program's not going to go anywhere. So what I would offer to you, the first step, the fundamental step, is your leadership team has to just absorb it and not react emotionally when you make a mistake. Some of them are going to be known because you can't hide the mess that it made. The other half is that they may not be known right away. It may be a latent error that sits in your system, and then later on you have to fess up like, oh yes, I did it that way. But the boss has got to be able to absorb it. If he can't, or if he kind of looks like it really bothers him, if it's, you know, scratching nails on the chalkboard by hearing about mistakes, it's going to be a very difficult culture to learn. They're going to hide their errors. They're not going to tell you what's going on, and you're not going to improve your system.
Well, there's two sides to this coin. There's getting the actual person who's out there doing the job and making the mistakes to fess up and say something and get comfortable with that. But then there's also training the management team to be comfortable with absorbing that. It's not easy. It's like you want to scream when you see something like that happen. How do you train people to, I guess, let go a little bit?
One effective tool I've used is let the mistake that occurs in the fessing up stay at the lower level initially till you find out more behind what it caused, what the system failures were at play. And I'm not saying to hide it from the CEOs in the higher levels, just give them time and patience. And what some of the success I've had in the past was just to coach them and go, this is what happened. Let's go take a systems approach to look at it. And then we'll come back and give you the filler of what we learned on the way. And that seems to whet their appetite, because they're like, you're aware of it. You know, now that you've got a full investigation that's going to take a look at the event, and you're not going to just point the finger at the person. We used to, one tool that I used to teach the workforce to get overcome this fear of, man, I can't believe I made a mistake. Now my job is on the line, was that we would, every week, we'd go over with the whole company. We'd have 600-700 people on these phone calls, and they were called flash calls, where we would share our investigations with the whole company. Mm-hmm. And we were showing that because we weren't faulting the individual. Instead, we were showing how our policies, the pressure, the culture played a part in it as well, our supervisor's role in the incident itself. And when we did that, we increased our reporting 9 times, because people were saying that we weren't approaching them with the finger in the chest saying, you know, you can't make mistakes, you got to be perfect.
It's just like it's part of the job. It's almost like the Kaizen manufacturing process that the Japanese use. It's just, hey, problems are going to happen. Let's identify them and then engineer them out.
Yeah, Heinrich has a rule that's 300 to 1. For one fatal accident, there was 300 near misses. So you're missing out on 299 learning opportunities if you can't just sit on the hands, let the process of investigating and coming up with good corrective action items. But the learning is phenomenal. You could say it's probably 300 greater if you can just be patient.
Well, speaking of learning from others and learning from lessons, in addition to your work as a safety leader, I understand you also give back by educating the next generation of pilots. Does your systemic approach to safety inform how you train those pilots?
Yeah, absolutely. What's happening is that the airline industry, its safety record has been so good for so long, the next generation of pilots aren't aware how we evolved. And so the accidents that we grew from, the accidents that happened at American Airlines in 1999 and what they call plane continuation bias, that's not known. But the lessons now have been incorporated into our SOPs and then incorporated into our checklist and human factors trainings that the airlines all provide. What I like in the book, some of the intent of the book is to teach the folks why we do things a certain way, why incident reporting is so important. When you make a mistake, I grew up in a much higher risk industry at the time. Now it's really minimal. The risk is still great, but it's reduced to such an acceptable level. Now, folks that we get, if you're 25, 29, they may not be inclined to report the error. So they have to understand that the reason why we do it is because we had an accident, TWA flight 514 going into Washington, D.C. And when the NTSB investigated a fatal accident, every airline had the exact same event occur. They just missed the mountain. And so they're like, you guys aren't sharing amongst each other, and you're really not sharing internally as well. They had a bulletin board up that would say, 22 miles away from Washington Dulles, there's a mountain out there. If you get a clearance that reads like this, that does not assure terrain clearance. Mm. And that wasn't good enough to get everybody's learnings across the whole system, because on that day of that accident, TWA had a pilot from another base flying to DC that didn't get that bulletin. And there's many other accidents as well. So we have to coach our younger generation of pilots that a lot of the reasons why we do things is because it was a hard lesson learned that was 20 to 30 years ago. I love that we're learning still from three decades ago, and there's still some learnings to occur today and every day, quite frankly, in the industry.
Yeah, the tough thing though is you can share wisdom, but you can't share the visceral fear or loss aversion that goes with it. So is there any way to get that into a training? I know you have simulators where you can put people under stress. I've seen that where pilots go into these simulators and it literally, you can see them sweating and they're stressed out. What can other organizations do to kind of, I guess, imbue that additional fear into people that goes along with the wisdom that really makes it stick?
I think you'll see some of the industries go into animations. And they do it from the first person. So I worked with an offshore operator and did a lot of their crane activities and the helicopter boarding procedures onto the helicopter deck on one of these offshore facilities, high risk activity. And they've had some fatal accidents in that aspect as well. But if you do it from the first person where you are the person walking through looking for hazards and the hazards can come out, reach out and hurt you, it's a very much more personal approach to safety than I've seen in the past. Yes, we have high-tech simulators in the industry that I think do a phenomenal job, maybe passing some of that fear factor into what we do for a living.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, what advice do you have for organizations that are continuously improving their culture of safety?
The foundation, if you want to be a high-reliable organization, the foundation's SOPs. You've got to capture how work is actually executed. And I'm not talking about procedures that are written on a shelf that are written by somebody who doesn't do the work themselves. The people who do the work should have a very major role in writing your SOPs. That's the foundation for excellence. Without it, you can't grow. You have to have organizational learning to those SOPs. They're not stagnant. They don't just sit on the shelf and go, hey, Andrew, we've got them. That's great. No, you have to challenge them when you have investigations. When people report near misses to you, you got to adjust them. And so everybody has the opportunity to learn from it. I heard the word competency all the time get thrown around. Competency is part skill, part knowledge. Your SOPs are your skill. The knowledge is the test that you can take, the competency part of it, that you can answer A through D and understand pressure limitations, electrical OSHA requirements. But skills is how I go execute that knowledge. And you SOP functions on both facilities. And the other thing, Peter, you got to keep it simple. Your operating system has to be broken down into simplicity in order for the frontline to go execute to the highest possible level.
And as you were speaking there, it just made me think that when we are out there doing our jobs, we all think, hey, if we're going to work 8 hours today, we're going to do that job for 8 hours straight. I'm going to fly a plane 8 hours straight. I'm going to operate this crane 8 hours straight. And that's not how we should look at things. It should be like maybe 80-20 rule. I'm going to do that 80% of the time, but I'm going to spend 20% of my time focusing on looking at what we could do better, how we could apply checklists, our approach to safety. And I bet that would actually make the 80% of the time you'd use doing the job even more effective than if you were just doing it 100% of the time.
I love where you're headed. Organizational learning, part of that element's debrief. And I came from another culture that we haven't talked much about. It was debriefing. After execution, we challenge how we did our work. And we look at it with the lens of, if you had to do it again tomorrow, what would you do differently? How would you do it better? And what did you learn along the way? And if you can get those micro learnings and then roll them back into your SOPs, your organizational learning system, you're going to get better and better and better. And then your people will also, their standard just continues to rise as well, now that you can measure them against with an SOP.
Yeah, I just got through watching Masters of the Air, that World War II show. Phenomenal. But at the end of every mission, I noticed when those guys came back and they were unbelievably stressed out, wounded, the immediate thing they would do is go to interrogation. They couldn't talk to anybody else, and they would sit down with someone who would just literally go through and ask them incredibly detailed questions to really understand what happened on the mission, but also to see what went wrong, what went right, so they could learn from that and do better going forward.
I love it. And yeah, I'm watching it too. I'm about 5 episodes. And my uncle, my grandfather's brother, was a B-17 pilot who unfortunately was killed over in England. So touches home a bit on it, but also it's an amazing show. And I love that you bring up the details of the debrief and how it occurs so quickly. A lot of corporate America's mistakes are they'll debrief 2 weeks after the event's over. And when I was out teaching dogfighting, I would have a piece of paper on my knee and I'd write little bitty notes during my dogfighting sequences so I could reconstruct what we were doing in the air on the ground. Same process. When we would land, we'd go right into the debriefing rooms. We actually had dedicated rooms to debrief. And then you would recreate it and spend about 45 minutes. You can make debriefs too long, which then it becomes like a meeting, and then meetings aren't fun. So I would say there's a specific objective to the debrief. And if I ask people, why do you debrief? That's to produce a lesson learned. And then that lesson learned has to go somewhere. And I'll go back to SOPs as the foundation. That's what we would migrate our lessons learned from dogfighting into our SOPs, our tactical SOPs.
Well, I think there's so much that we can learn from people who fly airplanes because so much is at stake, and we can take those lessons and then apply them to the industries that we're all in.
Absolutely.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much for the conversation. Enjoyed it.
To learn more about Andrew and his book, Delivering the Right Stuff, click on the links in the show notes. For video highlights from today's episode, just search for Alert Media on YouTube. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, the industry's most intuitive emergency communication and threat intelligence solution. To learn more about how to protect your people and business during critical events, visit alertmedia.com. Until next time.